Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight, number 414 for comics originally released on July 15th, 2015. Now, starting us off in DC is Dr. Fate number 2. Now, this is written by Paul Levitz. The storytellers are Paul Levitz and Sonny Liu, or I'm not quite sure how to pronounce Sonny's last name.
I think it's Liu.
We'll go with Liu. I kind of prefer it when they split, you know, Paul Levitz doing the writing, Sonny's doing the art and stuff like that, but they chose not to, so okay, that's fine. This is a very different Dr. Fate than we have seen before, but what I'm liking is it's respectful and similar enough to past Dr. Fates that I don't feel like they just kind of, you know, threw everything away and started from scratch. I did think that this was clearly it's a second chapter of a longer story, but I did think it stood alone reasonably well, given that it was, again, part of an ongoing narrative. I thought there was enough payoff, enough introduction and whatnot that you could have skipped the first issue and kind of get what's going on here. Did you read the first issue?
Yeah, I did.
What'd you think?
I think they're both pretty similar, actually. I think there's a lot of the reluctant hero going on here,
mm-hmm.
and he seems to keep fighting the pull to be Dr. Fate, and as you probably would. I mean, so that's kind of interesting because a lot of these stories where it's a reluctant hero, they get over it really fast, you know, and they accept that they're going to be that role. They're going to take on that role. And this is kind of cool in that it's stretching out. He still is not, he's not down for this, you know, and he has life plans. And he doesn't want them derailed by whatever this craziness is. And I thought that was cool that it stretched out over the first couple of issues. I remember reading any Dr. Fate really at all. So this is my Dr. Fate as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
I don't really have any kind of favorite Dr. Fate or I don't remember any experience. I have a couple comics laying around, but I don't remember them in any kind of real way.
Did you ever read much Justice Society?
No, I never did.
He was a member of that team. He was in the Justice League once in a while, not that often. Okay, so you're coming at it from a different point of view than I am, because I'm familiar with the previous Dr. Fates, of which it was mainly Kent Nelson, but we had his wife Inza for a while. We had another guy as Fate, and then, you know, one or two other, you know, variations on a theme. With that. And Nabu, who we see here as kind of a priest of Thoth or whatever, the wise, Nabu was the spirit of the helmet and kind of took over Kent Nelson, almost in a possession sort of thing. So Kent and Fate at certain times were very different people. Yet there was also at one point what I like to call the hero and the half helmet, kind of a nod to the TMNT stuff. Where it was not the full helmet, but a kind of a prop replica of it that Kent wore, and he could still do magic, but he didn't have Nabu and the big, powerful magic. Because with all heroes, you've got to go through the period of, ooh, they're too powerful, let's tone them down. So I like how this is, again, respectful and has some nods to Nabu and some of that stuff, but is charting new ground. As for him being a reluctant hero, I do think that there is a lot of fun with that potential of a almost permanently reluctant hero. But this is only the second issue, and this is taking place right on the heels of the first issue. So it's really the same evening where he got the helmet to begin with.
Right, right.
So it's...
I just don't remember a lot of that reluctance being spread out over multiple issues for other characters. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're entirely right. I think usually by certainly the end of the first story arc, sometimes by the end of the first issue, they've bought in and they're full gone, you know, into the hero mode. And I would like to see that play out slower here. him still doing the heroic stuff, but again, a little more reluctant. He's got a life, he's got a plan, and this is getting in the way. So I think there's some good story potential there.
I had glossed over the his ethnicity in the first issue and a half until I believe his father was in the hospital or something. And then I realized, oh, he's like Middle Eastern, maybe?
Egyptian, I believe.
Egyptian, yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, I just kind of missed that little detail, and it didn't change the way I was looking at it at all. I was surprised. It's like, okay, so this is kind of cool. We've got Ms. Marvel with some Pakistani heritage, and this character is Egyptian, so it's kind of a cool thing that the industry is doing, I think.
I'm assuming he's Egyptian because he has the blood of the pharaohs. I don't think they've clearly stated his ethnicity. Maybe they did in the first issue and I missed it, but his father making reference of not even being able to make prayers properly implies maybe Muslim, maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it wasn't clear.
But I do like the fact that they're trying to get something other than the standard Caucasian white guy, and that here they're not kind of beating us over the head with he is ethnic, you know, and this is what he is and that's all he is,
right,
kind of a thing.
Right. It was really subtle, and he's not a rich billionaire.
That's always nice, too. You know, not a blonde guy named Chris. So we know he won't be starring in any Marvel movies anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
This is another one, though, where you've got kind of the plain-clothed hero. You know, he gets the helmet, and apparently there's like a plate-looking thing that turns up on his chest. I don't know what exactly is going on with that. But this whole trend at DC right now to kind of get rid of the costumes and the standard trappings of superheroes, I got really mixed feelings on. You know, I think they're, particularly for this stage of a character, it kind of makes sense. But, you know, superheroes are superheroes and the costumes are kind of part of that. So I don't know if getting rid of that part of the genre really makes sense or not.
I think it makes it a little younger, skewing title, doing that reimagining of the character and with a younger look to his costuming. I do have a little issue with Sonny Liu's interpretation of this dog god. It was just gross and really demented looking and looked like a deer / greyhound or something that was just disgusting. And I think it would have been a better served as some other kind of incarnation, I think, than that, whatever that was. Now, does that have a history?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Again, they're going in some different directions in places, and that was one of them. But it did seem kind of weird.
Yeah, very weird. Yeah, there were some of those trippy moments where that are sprinkled in throughout this. And I mean, it didn't ruin it for me or anything, but I just took a second look and thought, oh, I don't know why you chose to go in this direction with the art.
The other one where the art seemed to not quite work for me was when he is rescuing the plane. There's a you know, he has an attempt of how to save it. He does it wrong, mentions it's an epic fail, yet the plane seems to be pretty much okay.
That was weird, too. I thought that maybe I needed to go back and see what I had... Maybe I had glossed over something because it didn't seem like he was going to be able to save it. And he had to choose the one person over the plane. And then he got the science behind how planes stay up in the air wrong. And yeah, and then the next thing you know, safe and sound on the ground. You're right. There seemed to be a missing panel or two.
Well, and there was a... before the page flip, it's like, oh, you know, I've got to do this. And it's like there should be a blast of air. And it almost seems more like a mystical lightning blast that hits the thing. So it's, I'm not
sure how that would help you land.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure the writer and the artist were on the same page on that, or if it really turned out the way they wanted. I mean, those are nitpicks or whatever. Overall, I thought this was a good read. I don't think it's going to just blaze up the sales charts or anything. I don't think it'll be a, you know, top of the sellers type stuff, but I do think it has some long-term potential. And this is one of those, if it can survive long enough to really get a fair shake and stuff, it could do all right. I'd like to see it get that chance.
Yeah, I would like to see it get to double digits, but I don't know. I don't know if it will or not. I don't know if it'll find an audience. I hope so. I hope so, because I thought it was pretty good as well. I gave this one a B minus. I liked the first one a little better. It was a B. The first issue was a B, and this is a B minus. But it's still a good read, and I just have some art issues, and I'm not sure I'm 100% sold on Sonny Liu and his storytelling art style.
Yeah, because I would say he's not a bad artist. I'm not crazy about the style, but it was really some of the storytelling where I thought he fell a little short, and it's just he may need some work. You know, for me, this was very much in that B-minus range also. It's better than average, but it needs a little bit more to really be, I think, a strong contender. I think it's worth checking out. I think it has potential, but if it makes it past the second story arc, I'll be very pleasantly surprised, but a bit surprised by that. I think it's just too competitive of a market right now. Not that it's never not a competitive market, but I don't know that it's really going to get noticed and get much of a chance. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Sure.
This is Captain Britain and the Mighty Defenders number 1. The writer is Al Ewing, and Alan Davis is on the art. Hard to go wrong with Alan Davis on art. And I don't think we did here. I think he did a great job. What I really enjoyed about this issue, it starts with a flashback to the origin of, you would think Iron Man, but really it turns out to be Rescue. And we get a couple of more pages where it's like, okay, this is clearly before an incursion. And then we get to now on Battleworld, how this realm is. And we get the backstory of a couple of these defenders in a way that really kind of clarifies the status quo of this world and the world they came from, which we've never seen before. So giving those highlights and stuff, it really, I thought, did a fun job there and showed how some of these characters realize, you know, they're not where they ought to be, but this is their status quo, and it's like that's not working totally for them. And then we get one of the members of Captain Britain and the MI5 group or whatever, one of the other defenders and stuff. So they're bringing a lot of characters into play that frankly are lower rung characters by and large. The Prowler, this version of Captain Britain, Rescue, and it's not even the main ones we've seen before and stuff. I like that. It's nice to see these characters getting a spotlight, and I would like to see other defenders showing up over the course of this series. It also showed what it means to kind of live in this battle world and how things can go not so good, and then introduces, you know, another group of characters. And I thought ended the issue on a, okay, let's see where they go next moment. That was kind of cool. Not a major dun-dun-dun, but this is one of the few titles that seems to be exploring completely new space in Battleworld versus let's trudge out, you know, a story from the past and just kind of revisit it. What were your thoughts?
I thought it was okay. I have this sense with these books, and there's been some exceptions of books that I've really liked, but for the most part, it feels like when you hear books getting canceled and, you know, there's still 6 issues left to play out the string or 4 issues left to play out the string before it's going to go away, and you just check out. And you're like, well, what's the point? What's the point? I wasn't in love with it anyway, so why am I even bothering?
Kind of a lame duck title sort of a thing?
Yeah, it's a lame duck title, and I feel like that about a lot of these. There are some that I have really enjoyed in spite of that, and they've been able to rise above that feeling. But the ones that are just average, I look at and I think, well, why do I care? Why do I need to stick with this? This is just okay, and why do I need to stick with it? Because it's only going to be around for a little bit, and then they're doing the all new, all different 8 months later stuff. So, and it's hard to break through that. In addition to the fact that, and this is in comics in general, so this is not about this specific comic, but the fact that there's only so much money to be spent, so much time to be spent reading comics, to break into that, you have an uphill battle. And then so to compound that with the fact that these stories are very, very temporary, and it takes a special book to break in and to be something that I really want to read another issue of. And this was okay. I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it enough to actually want to invest any more time into this title.
And that's because you think it really doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Six months, a year from now, we're not going to remember it.
There's nothing there's nothing in this story that says this is great. There have been some of these SWA titles that I've been, oh, that's really great. I really like that. And I'm going to keep reading that in spite of the fact that it's temporary and it's not going to be around and it'll be forgotten. So I read it anyway. But it takes a special book to be able to break through that extra obstacle, that comics don't need, because there's only so much to go around.
One thing I want to touch on real quick, you mentioned the SWA titles, SWA, that's how they're tagging everything in the shipping list and stuff like that. The SW, Secret Wars, I can never remember what the A stands for. Can you?
Oh, no, that's why I call it SWA. I just think it's dumb.
Well, I mean, it shows a clear misstep in the branding. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I agree with you in so much as a year from now, this title and many of these titles are going to be forgotten as the specifics is, oh yeah, they did some tie-in stuff. I'm liking how we're seeing different versions of characters, how certain things, you know, happened very differently. You know, instead of the world going left, it went right or whatever. So for me, the different take on things is fun. I enjoy that. But I also agree with you that next year, this is long since forgotten. The odds of this having any serious ramifications in whatever the new Marvel Universe, all new, all different, is unlikely.
Yeah.
And I can definitely see where that would turn people off on a lot of these books. But
have risen above the clutter for me. You know, I've enjoyed Thor's, and I've enjoyed where Monsters Dwell. I thought that was really well done. The 1872, I thought was really good. I mean, so there's some that have really elevated themselves above the chatter. But I think it's just an extra obstacle. You know, and I think coming on the heels of Convergence doesn't help. I'm a little gun shy on these things, these tertiary event books. So, for whatever reason, that's probably not fair.
I think it's totally fair. I mean, they do it too often, both Marvel and DC. Obviously, way less so with the other publishers. They don't have line-wide events, by and large. But, I mean, you look at during Flashpoint, prior to Flashpoint, to a degree leading up to Convergence and Convergence itself, there have been a lot of times at DC where it's like, you know, these books literally do not matter. We're just playing them out. Marvel hasn't had as many of those times, but there have been quite a fair number, you know, again, around events, when they go to a parallel world or timeline or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So they've brought that problem on themselves.
But if you know, if you're a reader and you're looking for something to fill in the Marvel hole in your collection while they're taking their time off, check this out. It's okay. I mean, there's nothing that says it's terrible. It's just I've got too much baggage. I think I've got too much baggage to enjoy it as much as the next person. And, that's caused me not to enjoy this, and that's probably why for me it's a C-.
Interesting. Again, I can see that. I see exactly where you're coming from. I don't share those feelings. I thought it was better than that, but the temporariness, the almost filling time aspect, I really can't argue with. I'm going to go with a B-, and the reason for that is I like what they're doing here, exploring, you know, different possibilities on how certain things could have gone for certain characters. And I like how they're exploring this aspect of Battle World that's ruled over by God Doom. And, you know, he's not really big into disbelievers.
No, that's true. That was kind of cool. You're right. That was kind of cool.
They're telling a good story here. Are they telling a brilliant story? Frankly, there are better ones being told on Battle World right now. There are also much worse ones being told. And these are low-run characters, so giving them their time in the spotlight I think is fun. I'm curious what the exit strategy for Marvel is with Secret Wars, how much of this is going to matter or not, and if titles like this really, you know, at the end of Secret Wars, hey, poof, it's gone, it's forgotten. A lot of readers, I think, are going to feel kind of, it's like, well, you wasted my time and money, and that's bad.
Are all these going to be 4 and 5 issues, enough to get a trade out of them?
I would imagine so, but until we see the solicits for, you know, what's happening after Secret Wars, we really, I don't know how long they're going to last. I would say 4, 5, 6 issues makes sense. Enough to fill out the trade is, I think, a safe bet. I mean, to not do that just seems silly.
And, you know, when I have some distance from this event fatigue that I'm experiencing, I could, you know, kind of look around at some of those, see what was well reviewed by others as a complete arc and revisit in trade form. And I think that's probably a better fit for me than trying to keep up with the issues and, you know, just with the fact that I am a little cynical.
I don't think being cynical is bad. I think the fact that the publishers are almost asking for event fatigue and cynicism is the problem. It's not like this is the first event Marvel's done in years or something. We've been getting them left, right, and center, same with DC, and frankly some other places too. So they've got to expect a little bit of a backlash, and they've got to expect if they don't bring out their A-game every time on all of these things, events are going to be seen with frustration, not excitement.
I think these have been, by and large, much more well-received than the Convergence minis were.
Absolutely.
And the anecdotal evidence from my LCS is that, yeah, there are racks of special back issues of dollar bins specially created for Convergence titles because they clog up the regular back issue bins. So they've kind of set those aside as their own back issues. And but Secret Wars are selling much stronger. So
that's just one
store, but, you know.
But it is a data point. And, you know, if somebody were to tell me that they heard of or saw a fire sale on Convergence where it's either sell it or burn it, that wouldn't surprise me either, because those were lackluster issues that really, after Convergence, mean nothing. It was a really flawed idea for an event. At least with Secret Wars, it's a better concept for the event. It's got some flaws too, but there are at least some really good stories, and the main story itself is really cool, whereas Convergence was lacking of that. So, you know, I don't expect everything to click with me like that Squadron Sinister did or some of the other stuff, but I at least appreciate that they're trying to do some different things here and there with Secret Wars. I'm just real curious if they've got a good game plan for afterwards, how much continuity of the Marvel Universe is getting, you know, jettisoned and thrown out, if we get a new timeline, some stuff like that. And if so, and this really kind of is their equivalent to Crisis on Infinite Earths, how does that impact Marvel going forward? Because I think if it comes out with, yep, new timeline, new history for everybody, a lot of what you've read, yeah, it kind of happened, except it didn't. Which is kind of what they did with DC with Crisis on Infinite Earths back in the day. There's major fallout from that over the years. And we'll see what happens. I'm hoping they've got a solid game plan, but, you know, I'm just not sure.
Yeah, time will tell.
Yeah, so, again, for me, I gave it a B-. It's fun stuff, but I see where you're coming from. And I don't know what the publishers can do to kind of get people like you out of that event fatigue and kind of re-energized, other than just tell really great stories. And ideally, without being, let's do another event. So, on that note, let's go over to Valiant, our other book, and Book of Death, and talk about another event. First thing I noticed when I opened up this Book of Death, and this is the regular one, not the incentive issue miniseries thing. When I get that next week or whenever, maybe I've got it now and I just didn't notice. Anyways, when I read that one, I may comment on that one too. But this is Book of Death number one. We've got Robert Venditti doing the story and Robert Gill and Doug Braithwaite doing the art. And man, the cover is just really kind of stiff, thick, substantial, which, I don't know, it just seemed weird. More so than most covers tend to be these days. Like, ooh, we're spending the money and giving you, you know, the prestige book, you know, the experience or whatever. I read this. It's kicking off the whole Book of Death event of such. And there was something about this where I just felt like it was good, but it was heavy on foreshadowing and with a lot of exposition to do that. It lacked explanations of a couple of things, how Eternal Warrior met Tama or whatever, and the events that got that part of the story starting. What happened with David a month ago? How did that come to be and go, forward and stuff? It's like I missed the first reel of the movie, if you will. And what we got here was good, but I felt too much like I was being, I was reading a story about somebody telling a story, because in places I was reading a story about somebody telling a story. And that right there just put some distance between me and what they're trying to tell me. Did you feel the same way? Did you feel differently?
Yeah, I agree. It was a little, it was very average. And, there was a point where I believe it was the XO story where they kind of handed off to the guy in the house with the little kid. I'm really butchering this. And there was a lot of geomancer exposition in here that just went on and on and on. And it was so heavy handed that I just kind of zoned out and just blew through it to get to something else because it just lost me. And I thought there's got to be a better way to tell this story than some of these really sloggy word balloons that just plod through the story. And I've seen it done really well. Kurt Busiek does this stuff really well. He brings you into a very new situation and a new status quo, and he mainlines you on that world with show don't tell stuff, and you're there and you get everything you need. And for some reason, when it doesn't work, it just bores me to tears with the exposition. You gotta be good, but I think there's a way to do that a lot better than this book did.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the comparison to Astro City is very interesting, because both this issue and a typical Astro City one involves some flashbacks, some let me tell you how things got to be the way they are sorts of things. And even in a typical Astro City, you're being explicitly told a story by somebody in the story, if you will, even if it's just a voiceover kind of thing, not like they're facing the camera or whatever. But here, it was literally somebody reading out of a book, and then we get text out of it. It was exposition. It was not great exposition, and it was more history book than prose novel sort of flashbacky thing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they're doing similar story conventions that you might find in an Astro City issue, but there it typically tends to be, like you said, very gripping, very engaging, and you're in the world. Here, it's just, I felt like I was almost getting the cliff notes of a really not that exciting story that was leading up to the current story, which is really not all that exciting either for me. It was a little bit of a tough read in some places. And again, I felt like I missed the beginning of the story to give it some context. Why are these characters in this position? How did this world get here? It was, frankly, a bit disappointing. It's hard not to couple that a little bit with the companion series, which is, again, I don't have that yet, but the whole concept of that, of you have to order so many of another as a retailer to even get the other book. So DCBS was charging essentially what it was costing them to get the other issue, to get that issue. I think Valiant made a couple of missteps in how they marketed this. I think the game plan for this event of let's foreshadow future stuff may limit their storytelling in the future, or at least either it's forgotten or it's not, and either way is a good point. You know what I mean? I didn't hate the issue. I thought it had a few moments here and there that were good, but it's one of those where for me, this was a little above average, but very little above average in kind of that C+ kind of area.
Go ahead.
For an event book, that's not good enough.
Right. I'm on the other side of C. I'm going to C- for this. And we've reviewed a lot of Valiant books on this podcast, and I've had some more positive experiences than others, but I'm still waiting for the one that I want to shove in somebody's hand because it's so good. You've got to be reading this. And I haven't found that yet. And we've given this publisher a lot of airtime to really get their hooks in me and other readers. And I know there's some real Valiant loyalists out there too. I mean, I know Mike Myers reads, I think, all of them, the whole line. There's some other folks that pick and choose. I think Sam just reads a couple. Mm-hmm. Maybe he used to be all in, and now just picks a couple. So they do have their fans, and it's just not hitting it with me.
Well, I don't know that this is kind of a creative high point, either this issue or this point in Valiant. At one point, I would have said Archer and Armstrong was a must read. I thought they had a really good run on that. There's been some stuff on Bloodshot that I thought was really solid. Same with Exo. At the moment, though, I don't think we're getting their A game. Not that the creators are holding back or anything of the sort. It's not at least clicking with me as much as I would like it to. So I get where you're coming from. I don't know what exactly is not kind of working there. I don't know if they just don't have a solid lead creator or somebody kind of guiding their world or whatever, a editor-in-chief or whatever position that would be for them, and maybe that's where things are going not so right. The Book of Death in and of itself, just the title of it, geez, that's so cheery. I question if that was the right approach, and I don't know. I don't think they needed another event right now. You know, I thought they did some good stuff when they first crossed over Harbinger and Bloodshot and stuff. But trying to tie their whole universe together and give it almost a predestination aspect, it's a questionable choice.
Yeah, I'm curious to see. I know their sales were trending downward, and they were below 10,000 with a lot of these titles. And then they started doing the various relaunches of miniseries and put some of their titles, which were really their strong titles, on the shelf for a while, and to go through these little miniseries. So I'd be curious down the road, when there's some sales data to look at, just how this paid off for them.
Great question. And at some point I'll see if I can put together a chart of just how their various titles have kind of been doing over time, just to see how, at a glance, Valiant kind of how their sales look. I think that would be fairly interesting. They're capable of some great stuff. They do good, solid production level packaging and stuff like that. They've got some good creators. I just think the direction they're heading creatively is a little lackluster, and that's where they need to focus. And I don't think it would take much to I don't want to say turn things around, but to improve things greatly for them. So I'm still way behind on my reading. I've gotten up to the week of June 10th that I'm starting to
oh my god.
Well, I had some stragglers in May and stuff, so I had to get those caught up and stuff. So I've pretty much read these books. The only other thing I read, because you had mentioned it last week, was not only Archie number 1, but the preceding Archie 666.
Oh, okay.
And as I was going through that final issue of the old volume, I thought it was a really nice end to the original series. It had aspects that, you know, was referring to his 666th detention. Weatherby had enough. He was just gonna expel Archie and the world would end, sort of a thing for them. So it was kind of a little slightly metatextual, whatever, in terms of, you know, what will the world be like, you know, after that sort of a deal. But It was cool. It was Archie. It fit. It worked as an ending issue. But there was an aspect of that issue, and I kind of felt that way here too, where I'm wondering, and I don't know, but is Archie Comics serializing these things digitally first? Because that issue, and I think this one too, seemed to have like three chapters.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Such that they could have just serialized it in thirds. And that's not a bad thing, but it's not necessarily different than the way Archie's stories have been told for who knows how long. But it makes me wonder if this is the first time this is seeing the audience or not. And man, this Archie number 1, on the one hand, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. On the other hand, it also had a very strong kind of Saved by the Bell vibe to it. I mean, when we open and Archie is talking to the camera, that right there made me think, okay, this is Zach from Saved by the Bell. And that's not a bad thing. I thought that was a decent show. But it while this was a good modernization of the characters, the status quo and whatnot, I felt there were some serious changes to the premise, the setup, the relationships of a couple of the characters and whatnot. But Fiona Staples did a great job in the art. It was clearly Archie, Betty, and the gang without being the iconic versions of them. And this is something that I could see turning into if they did Saturday morning live action shows like Saved by the Bell, I could see it turning into one of those. Or a Disney Channel sort of a thing. Or Nickelodeon, or I don't know what the right TV venue would be these days. I liked the modern sensibility. I liked it also having a little bit of a timeless aspect to it in sense. There was something about Reggie that still looked 1950s-ish, but not out of time for today. And there are, an Easter egg or two, somebody, having a hat or whatever that was, reminiscent of stuff in Saga and whatnot was a nice little Easter egg. Great writing, solid art. I'm going to stick with it for a bit. I'm curious how long this take kind of lasts and if and when we're going to see the classic Archie back, if this is just a go for a little bit and then revert, or if this is just how Archie's going to be now. So I was pleased. It was fun. It was good.
I kept looking for Hazel and other characters from Saga to pop up because, Fiona Staples' art is very signature style. I mean, it's really great art. It is really great art. But yeah, there was a lot of reminiscent of some of the characters that have been in Saga, and just the way the hair is drawn, or the face, or I saw that the little hat callback in there. But I thought it had modernized. I really thought it was cool the way they modernized this cast. And I was reading some of the Afterlife with Archie stuff too, which is a pretty cool take with zombies and things. I enjoyed that as well. So yeah, I never read a lot of Archie back in the day, but I kind of like this take. I thought it was fresh and interesting, and I don't think Fiona Staples is going to stick around through 5 issues, maybe. I think what I hear, she's going to do like the first 5 and then go back to Saga. So I don't know if I'll stay past that. But I did really enjoy this take, and I think it's worth checking out. I thought the story was pretty good, and art was wonder to behold. So it's cool. Check it out. Yeah.
I think after Fiona Staple leaves, assuming she does, and I think it's wouldn't be surprising if she does. Again, they got Saga to do. There are a couple others that I think could easily step in and do just as good of a job. Looking at this cover gallery in the back, the Mike Norton stuff, the Ron Salas stuff. There are a number that I think have a similar enough style, or it's not even just the style. It fits with what I think Wade's trying to do. And, Wade did a good job, like you said, modernizing it, capturing the teen sensibility without it feeling fake, forced, or anything of the sort. But once this arc is over, do these creators stay or not? And if so, who replaces them? And do people stick around for that or not? I don't know.
Yeah. That would be a big surprise if it. I think this sell is going to sell through the roof. I think this first issue is going to sell really well.
Absolutely.
And, I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it's in a loot crate, but it should still sell healthily, I would think.
It will probably be one of the highest selling Archies we've had in as far as I can remember, which admittedly isn't necessarily all that far without my database in front of me.
And 40 variant covers probably will help as well.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of curiosity.
Yeah.
This is a high profile relaunch. It's the first time in 75 years they've relaunched Archie. So that I think a lot of people are going to come out, check out the first issue, and there'll be a good drop, a huge drop on the second issue.
Yeah, there definitely will.
But I think it'll still wind up well above where it had been.
Yeah. And if this thing sells in the 50,000s through the first arc, 50,000-60,000, that was a win. That was a great relaunch for them.
I think even if it does half that or a third of that, it's a big win for them. I mean, in the direct market, Archie's not a major factor. So if it's competitive with other stuff,
yeah,
that's a big win.
Yeah, so if you can convince the 2,000 or so retailers to put it on the shelf, consistently through that first arc, that's great because they don't normally do it.
What we might see is great sales for the first issue, big drop on the second, but then the month after that, reorders on the second. Because I think there are going to be more people sticking around for the second issue than retailers would probably expect.
Mm-hmm.
And no disrespect to the retailers. I think it's one of those that people could have looked at this and said, yeah, it sucks. I'm moving on. But again, Mark Waid, Fiona Staples, that's a high-profile creative team. They've got an audience, and they did a good job on this. So it's going to be fun to see how the story plays out and how the sales go and just where this all goes over the next couple of months.
Yeah, it was a cool relaunch, and glad I read it.
Yeah. So the previews spotlight deadline, that's going to be the morning of Saturday, August 8th. We're back on the regular schedule. As we record this, I guess previews is still coming out the 29th, so we haven't seen that yet. I believe the solicits are online. I'll be honest, I've really not gotten back on the forum since I've gotten back from Comic-Con and stuff. I'm still...
Yeah.
Catching up on podcast editing, reading, and stuff like that. But I need to go find those solicits so I can figure out what the comic book page picks are going to be for next month.
I think there's some people already staking their claims on what they're going to send clips in. So
awesome.
Yeah, there must be plenty of them out there.
I thought I had seen Jason from Hawaii, Mr. Aloha, had posted some links and stuff.
And Chris Braylinator.
Awesome. So I appreciate you guys doing that. Thank you so much. And again, the preview spotlight, send in pics. I really appreciate it. That's how I find out about a lot of stuff. Particularly right now, there were like a bazillion announcements during Comic-Con, of which I heard maybe two. I don't know, three maybe. I don't know. So it's easy for me to have missed a lot of these announcements, as it's easy for other listeners and stuff. So highlight what you're interested in. Let people know. It's a great way to share the love for comics. And again, that's what the podcast is all about. So... anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
That does it for me.
Cool. Join us next time as we discuss Cyborg number 1 from DC, Star-Lord and Kitty Pryde number 1 from Marvel, and Infinite Loop number 4 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.